It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the Trump administration has proposed steep tariffs on newsprint being imported from Canada. We'll find out how newspapers and publishing companies in Wisconsin could be affected. First, Wisconsin's unemployment rate hit a record low last month. The preliminary estimate shows that unemployment dropped to 2.9% in February, making it the lowest level in Wisconsin's history. Governor Walker highlighted those numbers during his weekly radio address this morning, saying the state has come a long way over the last decade.
All this is a stark contrast to 8 years ago when the unemployment rate hit 9.2% at the start of 2010. Wisconsin had lost more than 130,000 jobs in the 4 years before we took office. Our focus back then was on jobs, jobs, jobs. Now it's on workforce, workforce, workforce.
Our next guest is here to talk about what the numbers mean and what it says about the state's economy. Steve Deller is a professor of agriculture and applied economics and the interim director for the Center for Community and Economic Development at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and UW Extension. Steve, welcome back to the show.
Good afternoon.
Well, as an economist, your reaction to these unemployment numbers in this monthly report?
This is really remarkably low. Level of unemployment. You have to go back for Wisconsin, you have to go back to the late 1990s to see something this low. Generally, when we think about what's kind of the natural rate of unemployment, that's just kind of reflection of the churn in the economy. Economists argue, is it 4%? Is it 4.5%? But when you get below 3%, that's pointing to something.
And when it's down that low, in my limited understanding of economics, that means wage pressure might go up. Have we seen increasing wages to go along with these low unemployment numbers?
No, we have not.
Why would that be?
Well, there's a couple of things that are going on here. First of all, we've been looking at kind of this evidence of pushing wages up, and we're not seeing it. But the data that we're looking at, there's a little bit of a lag time in there, so it may not be reflecting, what's happening exactly today. But there's problems in the sense of that a lot of the jobs that we've created in Wisconsin simply can't afford to pay the wages and offer the benefits that are attractive to people. So I think if you have businesses that are paying competitive wages, offering decent benefits, a good work environment, I don't think that they're having a hard time hiring workers. It's the ones that simply cannot afford to raise wages and see that upward pressure that they're the ones that are really kind of suffering.
So what kind of businesses are you talking about? I imagine it's businesses with tight margins where there isn't that wiggle room.
Exactly. These are firms that the only way that they can drive their profitability is to keep costs down. And one of the big costs for a lot of firms is labor cost. And if they start to raise wages in order to attract workers, they start losing money and they won't be in business very long.
So what sectors would fit that category?
What we kind of call commodity products. This would be a good example would be dairy. Dairy farmers really don't have much control over the price of milk. So the only way that they can drive profitability is to keep an eye on cost. You look at a lot of the manufacturing that's in Wisconsin, a lot of it is commodity-based driven. A lot of our cheese production goes into commodity markets, so they don't have much control over their prices. And that puts them between a rock and a hard place.
Now, how about the labor force participation? Now, that's another factor when we hear the unemployment number. That's part of the story, but there's also the story of some people are or aren't factored into that based on whether they've given up looking for work. Do we know what we're seeing in Wisconsin with that lately?
There are different measures of unemployment, and there's a couple that, and the one that we report on a monthly basis like this is called U3. But there are other ones to look at, people that have been unemployed for more than 15 weeks, people that have that are working part-time, want full-time. Even when you look at those broader measures, the unemployment rate is still at remarkably low levels. So it's essentially, people that want to find a job, they're able to find a job. The question is whether or not they're the types of jobs that are they can be retained.
And how do we compare on unemployment with the rest of the country? It seems like the trend usually is Wisconsin tracks national trends, but our unemployment is a little lower. Do I have that right?
That's correct.
And is that what we're seeing recently?
I think that's what we're seeing, yes.
And that holds true in a bad economy and a good economy. We're usually a little bit better in that raw percentage than the country as a whole.
The only state that consistently beats us in that regard is Iowa. Iowa always has a lower unemployment rate than we do. But generally, you're right. We generally have low levels of unemployment compared to the nation.
Now, we heard from Governor Walker there talking about 2010, a higher unemployment rates, 9-point-something% back then. That was at the bottom, kind of the Great Recession. Can you talk about how Wisconsin is following national trends versus charting its own path when it comes to jobs?
We weren't, as bad as the Great Recession was, we weren't hit as bad as the national economy was. So in that regard, our unemployment rate, although it was high, it was still below the national average. The national unemployment rate is tracking down, but we are, again, tracking down a little bit lower than that. The only difference between the Wisconsin and the national economy is that our rate of recovery has been slower than the national economy. And we've been trying to figure out what it is about Wisconsin that's been driving that.
Do we have any ideas?
Not yet. How long have you got to talk?
Right. I mean, is it something, and this is a question that I come back to a lot. I've probably asked you this a few times. How much control over its own economy does a state like Wisconsin have versus we're riding the currents of the national or global economy?
It's the national and global economy, but the state sets the tone. For example, the recent initiative to try to put advertising in the Twin Cities in Chicago and Detroit to try to attract millennials, that's not really going to work. What millennials are looking for is things like investments in schools, investments in environment, investment in transportation and public safety, investment in things like broadband, quality of life type factors. So the state can influence that by how they decide to invest money. And Wisconsin, unfortunately, has been pursuing cut taxes, and that means cut programs. And that's not really what a lot of millennials are looking for.
Talking to Steve Deller from UW-Madison and UW-Extension, looking at very low unemployment numbers here in Wisconsin. We also heard the governor talk about something he's been saying for a while now. We need to focus on workforce. That's part of that advertising initiative. Yes. You just mentioned trying to get workers into the state. We've got low unemployment numbers, and then this Foxconn deal coming in. A lot of employees needed there. Is Wisconsin, in certain sectors, maybe even the better-paying job sectors, going to have trouble filling those jobs?
I think with Foxconn, if you bring that up, no, I don't think Foxconn's going to have a hard time, primarily because they are paying fairly good wages, and you have the Chicago labor market to tap into, and you have the Milwaukee labor market to tap into. So I don't think Foxconn's going to have a hard time finding workers. It's a question of where they're going to be coming from.
Are they going to be coming from Wisconsin? Are they going to be commuting from across the border is one question people have raised.
I think they're going to be a lot commuting from across the border. One thing that we have been looking at, a colleague of mine, Matt Kears, in the Center for Community and Economic Development, has been looking at what we call stretch commuting. And it's defined as people that commute more than 50 miles one way to work. And what we're finding over the past 10 years is the willingness of people to commute greater distances to take jobs has been growing, and growing rather rapidly. We're not sure if people are being pushed into longer commuting or they're being pulled into it for better jobs. But I think with Foxconn, the types of jobs that they're being offered, I think there's going to be a lot of people that are going to be pulled into those jobs and willing to commute greater distances.
Now let's talk about workers who have been hard hit by changes in manufacturing, in particular, the workers with a high school education, with some college or no college. What is the job situation looking like for them in Wisconsin?
If they're willing to commute, or if they're willing to relocate, I think that there's tremendous job opportunities. I think one of the problems that we've got in the state is what we call a spatial mismatch. And it's part of that commuting thing, is that we have a lot of jobs over in this part of the state, but we got a surplus of labor in another part of the state. You can oftentimes think about it in terms of like a surplus of labor in inner city Milwaukee and a deficit of workers out in the suburbs. They're just not spatially matching up. Now this comes into questions about transportation policy, public transportation, road investments, all sorts of policies.
And there's a national story too about jobs in more expensive cities. Dane County kind of fits into this a little bit. And great, you want to relocate there. Can you afford to move there? Can you afford to live there?
That is something that we're actually looking at. A lot of communities in Wisconsin are concerned that the reason that they're having a labor shortage is because of housing. People are not able to move into the housing market. And it's one of two things. One is the housing market is either too expensive, or the housing market is, or the housing condition is not very good housing. It's just not been maintained. It's not in a state of repair. That is something that we're trying to look at. And when you look at housing stress and you compare us to the rest of the nation, we look pretty good compared to the West Coast, compared to the kind of the Boston-Washington corridor. We look fine.
I want to throw you an economic curveball, a little tangentially related here, Steve. In a few minutes, we're going to talk about one kind of tariffs. The president is announcing tariffs targeting China. We've been hearing about the steel and aluminum. Looking at Wisconsin's economy, just briefly, what do you have hopes or worries when it comes to tariffs and how they'll affect the state?
I have real serious concerns. A lot of the manufacturing in the state relies on steel. And much of this manufacturing, again, doesn't have control over the prices that it can charge. So if you start upping the price of steel, and they're going to have to cut costs someplace else because a lot of these firms can't pass the cost on to the consumer. So it's going to put a lot of firms between a rock and a hard place. And if you start a trade war with China, we're going to lose because they're in a better position to ride that out. So this is... this whole kind of, we can win a trade war. You cannot win a trade war. So this is scary. It's going to put the brakes on the economy.
Steve, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Stephen Deller, professor of agriculture and applied economics and interim director of the Center for Community and Economic Development at UW-Madison and UW-Extension. Joins us today to look at the latest unemployment numbers in Wisconsin and the economic outlook for the state. The Trump administration's new steel and aluminum tariffs have been making headlines lately, along with new tariffs targeting China. But they're not the only moves in the trade world getting attention. The Commerce Department has proposed new tariffs on uncoated groundwood paper being imported from Canada. And in that category, newsprint. And the potential tariffs have newspapers, publishers, and printing companies in Wisconsin worried. They're joining with groups around the country opposing the idea, saying it could result in the loss of jobs and even affect news reporting. Rich Kramer is a WPR reporter based in Eau Claire. Rich, thanks for being back on the show.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, what is being proposed when it comes to tariffs, changes in tariffs for this Canadian newsprint?
Well, basically, the tariffs work out to about anywhere from 0% to 22.6%. And these tariffs are being levied against specific Canadian paper companies that the Commerce Department and a petitioner, that is a Washington paper company, say they're getting subsidized to kind of flood the market with newsprint that is cheaper than fair value.
And do we currently have existing tariffs on this Canadian newsprint?
There have been two rounds. The investigation was started last August after this petitioner called for it. It's North Pacific Paper Company based in Washington State. They claimed that these companies were selling paper, specific paper. I mean, we're talking something called uncoated groundwood paper. They were selling it at 23 to 55% below value. Commerce did an investigation. They said, well, it's not quite that much. So the first round of tariffs came in January, and those ranged from about a half of a percent to around 10%. And then just last week, Commerce Department announced that they were going to tack on some more tariffs, ranging up to just over 22%.
And the argument here is that this is unfair competition from these Canadian companies that is potentially hurting American makers of this paper. Is that the general justification?
Absolutely. That these companies are flooding the market, that it's putting American newsprint producers at a disadvantage. And so they were seeking relief.
And now newspaper companies affected by this, they're speaking out in opposition. And you talked to the Wisconsin Newspaper Association. They're joining this national effort. What kind of concerns did they raise?
I spoke with James DeBilzen, who's a spokesman for the Wisconsin Newspaper Association, last week. He says that the concerns are that the U.S. doesn't make enough of this type of paper to supply the demand in Wisconsin. Here's what he said, or in the nation.
I mean, the reality is we need Canadian newsprint in this country because we just don't produce enough ourselves. So that's where this has become this perplexing issue is, we can't get by without having Canadian newsprint. We can't supply enough here in this country as well.
So the idea is that this shortage is going to drive up prices, and a lot of the newsprint users are, you know, small weekly papers that might not be able to afford it. There are suppliers, even in Wisconsin. I mean, we used to be known as a big paper state. Not so much anymore. A lot of the companies, DeBilzen told me, have kind of transitioned to specialty paper or even corrugated cardboard. So sourcing this newsprint has become a lot more difficult than it has been in the past for his members.
So is the worry that they might not be able to find enough paper, or it's just going to cost them significantly more?
He said that it's, you know, with it already being kind of difficult to find, he said these printers are going to have to spend a lot more time trying to source it. They're going to have to buy it probably, you know, much more in advance and maybe get more at a time when they do it, which is just going to be another headache on top of an industry with newspapers specifically that doesn't have the biggest margins.
Talking to Rich Kramer, WPR reporter based in Eau Claire, looking at new proposed tariffs on a particular kind of paper coming from Canada. It's uncoated groundwood paper, better known as newsprint, the stuff newspapers are printed on. Rich, we're seeing that the CEO of Quad Graphics is also joining this effort, saying that this is going to result in a loss of jobs. And that's a pretty big employer in parts of Wisconsin. Do you have a sense of how employment might be affected if these get put into place?
Hard to say. When I spoke with the Wisconsin Newspaper Association, it was like the first blush comment that I got. But there's a national group that formed, and it's an acronym, STOPP, S-T-O-P-P. Basically, it stands for Stop Tariffs on Printers and Publishers. And this group does say that sources for newsprint has been shrinking, and this is going to make it harder for. I mean, we're not just talking about newspapers. We're also talking about, this is the same paper that goes into books, so book publishing companies, you name it. And this group of industry folks and even some congressional delegates from New Mexico are lobbying Congress to step in and block it. How likely that is to happen, it's hard to tell, hard to say. And we're kind of lucky, is what I've heard from DeBilzen of the Wisconsin Newspapers Association, because we're in an area that does have some sources. He said the southeast of the U.S. is going to be really in trouble because they don't have a lot of, they have to ship their paper from much farther away, obviously, because there's not a big thriving timber or paper industry in that corner of the nation.
Now, we're talking kind of how this will affect costs at newspapers. Is there a concern that this could affect the news, the reporting that goes on?
I haven't gotten that impression, and again, I've basically scratched the surface of this, but, newspapers are shrinking anyway, so maybe this could be a nail in the coffin, but that's speculative. I'm not sure.
And is there a concern that this would affect smaller papers, maybe in rural areas that don't have a lot of news service to begin with?
Definitely. That seems to be the main concern from the Wisconsin Newspaper Association. Again, if a lot of us have weeklies in our area, in our regions, that are shoestring budgets for them. I mean, to put it lightly.
And as you say, this opposition is just starting now. Do you get a sense from talking to the Newspaper Association of Wisconsin that it's going to be kind of a full court press to try to stop these tariffs?
It seems to be. When I talked to DeBilzen, and this was just days after the announcement was made, and as I spoke to him, because the top leadership from that group and also from a lot of the weekly newspapers were in Washington, literally at that moment lobbying congressional delegates.
And what is the next step in potentially, it's not a done deal yet, potentially implementing these tariffs?
Right. So we're talking about a preliminary order. This all gets very confusing, but at this point, it's not set in stone. The final order is going to be scheduled right now for August 2nd. So it sounds like there's some wiggle room at this point, but even though it's preliminary, the Commerce Department has ordered the U.S. Customs and Border patrol folks to get cash payments from truck drivers that are bringing this newsprint across the border. So even though it's preliminary, it seems to have some pretty real impacts and potentials for Canadian companies to just stop sending their newsprint here. But I haven't figured out what extent that's happening yet.
So wait, I hadn't. So actually, when trucks cross the border, they're asking for a tariff?
Yes.
On the spot?
Well, that's the way it was in the order. It says Commerce Department is instructing U.S. Customs and Border Protection to require cash deposits based on these preliminary rates. So, you know, I'm not an expert in this, but it sounds like they'd have to pay up before getting it into the U.S.
And are people like the Wisconsin Newspaper Association trying to rally, not just directly lobby, but are they trying to get Wisconsin's congressional delegation on board? You said delegations in other states are getting in on this effort.
Right. I haven't really seen, there were some concerns from, say, Paul Ryan said he had concerns about this, as he had general concerns about the steel and aluminum tariffs as well. But I haven't heard to what extent these industries are directly lobbying, and I haven't really seen any definitive statements from members of Congress or, you know, the U.S. Senate from Wisconsin one way or the other on this issue.
Rich, thanks a lot for bringing us up to date.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to Rich Kramer. He's a WPR reporter based in our Eau Claire bureau. He joined us for a look at these proposed tariffs on a particular kind of paper coming from Canada. The paper used, among other things, to print newspapers, the impact it could have on printing companies here in Wisconsin, and new lobbying efforts, including by the Wisconsin Newspapers Association, to try to prevent those full tariffs from coming into effect. Still a developing story. We know that the foods we eat can affect the way we feel, but how about the way we think? That's the question behind a new book, Brain Food: The Surprising Science of Eating for Cognitive Power. Author Lisa Mosconi is a neuroscientist and nutritionist and associate director of the Alzheimer's Prevention Clinic at Weill Cornell Medical College. She says food has a direct impact on our brains, short and long term, so what should be on our menu? Lisa, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Well, as a neuroscientist, how did you become interested in how food affects our brains?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. So I have been a scientist and a neuroscientist for about 15 years, and it never occurred to me that I would be talking about food. My background is very much biology, and I have a dual PhD in neuroscience and nuclear medicine, so it's really... You know, it's very, very far from diet and nutrition. But after years, my research showed that your genetics are important only up to a certain point, and your lifestyle actually plays a huge role in determining whether or not you're going to age gracefully with your mental capacities intact. So I went back to school, and I've completed another degree in nutrition, and then I actually started really looking into that, and I find it fascinating. We don't think about nutrition as something integral to the medical field, but we really should. And I think for anybody who's ever done chemistry, then nutrition is very, very familiar in some ways, because the nutrients that we put into our bodies really change the physiology of our body and brain. So it's something that we should really start to look into consistently.
And you say when we look at scans of people with drastically different diets, there are actually physical and observable differences in those brains, right?
Yes, yes. That's exactly what we do at Weill Cornell and what I've been doing for years. I founded and directed the Nutrition and Brain Fitness Lab at NYU Medical a couple of years ago, and we started using brain imaging to look at people's brains today and try and correlate their lifestyle in terms of diet, nutrition, but also fitness, sleep, intellectual stimulation with the way their brains look on brain scans. And diet has a huge impact. Literally, if you put side by side the MRI scan or some kind of scan of a person who's been eating healthily for a long time, their brain will just look good. Whereas the brains of people on an unhealthy diet, like rich in processed foods and fried foods and fast food and too much animal food in some ways, they will look much older, even though these people are exactly the same age. So an unhealthy diet seems to really push your brain to age faster.
And our big goal here is to keep our brains healthy for as long as possible and hopefully to stave off Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia. Food, the choices we make of what we eat can really make a significant difference, you're telling us?
Yes, yes. There is consensus at this point among scientists that at least one-third of all Alzheimer's cases could be preventable by improving our lifestyle. And that includes anything from improving cardiovascular fitness, intellectual stimulation, physical fitness, and really eating better has a really big impact.
Talking to Lisa Mosconi, neuroscientist and nutritionist, talking about her new book, Brain Food, The Surprising Science of Eating for Cognitive Power. Lisa, let's get into what we can eat to be healthier. Take a look at, say, a pretty standard American diet. Where can we make some of the quickest improvements that are going to make a difference if we stick with it in the long run?
Good. So I think the first improvement is drink water.
Drink water.
Italian? Yes. I'm sure if everybody can tell from my accent, I'm Italian. And when I moved to New York 15 years ago, the first thing I noticed is that nobody drinks water. And as a neuroscientist, I have to tell you, the brain is mostly made of water. Over 80% of the brain's content is water. And every single chemical reaction that takes place in the brain needs water to occur, even energy production. So if you don't have enough water, your brain will not have enough energy. And the brain is so sensitive to dehydration that even a minimal loss of water, like a 2-4% dehydration, which is not clinical dehydration, it's just very subtle, but it's enough to really cause symptoms like brain fog, fatigue, dizziness, confusion. And even worse, brain imaging studies have shown that mild dehydration makes your brain shrink. And you don't want your brain to shrink, right?
Right. I imagine not.
No. So we really need to drink enough for our brains. And I think the problem in the States is that even people who drink water very often drink purified water, like the kind of water you find at the airport, and seltzer, club soda. Those are just not really water. There are no nutrients in those water preparations, if you will, that will keep your brain and your body hydrated. So they contain no minerals and no electrolytes at all. So they're just not rehydrating. And that could be a big problem.
And then sticking with beverages, switching—if we could switch from soda or a pop, depending on where you are in the country—to water, ideally water with minerals still in it—that's a big difference maker.
I believe so. Yeah.
And then let's get into the food we eat. Now there are a lot of fad diets out there, or I don't know, people who do them don't think they're fads. But what are some simple things that we should be adding to our regular weekly diets?
Right. So there are some foods that have been proven to really support brain health and reduce risk of dementia, especially in the long term. I would say the number one brain food is fish. And a lot of people don't really eat fish nowadays. So fish is fantastic in terms of is a great brain food because it's really rich in omega-3 fatty acids, which is basically the only kind of fat that the brain needs to be constantly replenished on a daily basis. And they also contain a very important nutrient like choline. It's a B vitamin that is needed to make memories. So fish is a really good brain food, especially cold water fatty fish like salmon. But understanding that salmon can be expensive, then other options that are more affordable would be mackerel, bluefish, sardines, anchovies. Those are all really high in omega-3s that our brains really need pretty badly, like consistently. And then another brain food is dark leafy greens, like spinach, Swiss chard. I'm very partial to dandelion greens. Very Italian to eat them. All sorts of greens. They are really full of vitamins, minerals, fiber, and all sorts of disease-fighting nutrients. They call phytonutrients that are needed for a healthy nervous system. Do I keep going?
We'll pause for a moment. We're talking to Lisa Mosconi about her new book, Brain Food. She's associate director of the Alzheimer's Prevention Clinic at Weill Cornell Medical College and New York Presbyterian Hospital. She says the foods we eat can affect the way we think and the long-term health of our brains. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for our guest about brain health and the best foods to eat to preserve that health for today and for 30 years from now? Are there foods that you go to and at least think, yeah, this is good for my brain? Do you want to have her tell you if it is or not? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. We continue our conversation about foods that aren't just good for our bodies, they're good for our brains. Lisa Mosconi is with us. Her new book is called Brain Food. She's associate director of the Alzheimer's Prevention Clinic at Weill Cornell Medical College. She's a neuroscientist and a nutritionist. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about what we can eat to preserve our brain's well-being? Call 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Chris is with us in Hudson. Chris, hi.
Hey, how are we doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
I'm just wondering if there's a neurological difference in how our brains react to receiving nutrients from foods versus nutrients from nutritional supplements. For instance, is there a difference in the omega-3 gains from eating fish versus eating or ingesting omega-3 as a nutritional supplement?
Got it, Chris. Thanks for the call. So, Lisa, is it better to get it from the food, or does it work to get nutrients like omega-3 from a supplement?
It's a really good question, and I think we need more research to really draw conclusions. But so far, it looks like nutrients from food are superior to nutrients from supplements, especially as far as antioxidant vitamins go. Like, for instance, vitamin E or vitamin C are often recommended for aging and prevention of dementia in people who are deficient or, you know, have some kind of deficiencies. And it was shown that the natural forms of these vitamins contain many different subforms. Like for vitamin E, there are 8 different natural varieties, so to speak, in nature. And when you eat foods that contain vitamin E, you get all the 8 forms, whereas the supplements only contain 1. So they have limited benefits as compared to a food that is very rich in natural sources of the same vitamins.
Thanks for that call, Chris. We'll go next to Kate with us in Twin Lakes. Kate, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to bring up, Kate?
So I just had a question about salmon and choosing between freshwater versus, mercury levels and what I should be concerned about. And also, like, with sushi types of fish and eating raw fish and being concerned about the mercury levels.
Kate, thanks for the call. So, yeah, Lisa, we hear that fish is very healthy for us. In some fish populations, there is that concern about mercury contamination.
Yeah, it's a very legitimate concern, and I think, again, we need more research to be sure that it's an actual problem. I think a safe way to go about it is to limit intake of fish that could potentially contain mercury, and also try to balance that out with smaller fish like anchovies or sardines. The smaller ones are usually safer, especially wild caught.
Kate, thanks for that call. Earlier, Lisa, you mentioned grains earlier as a good type of brain food. Here you're talking whole grains, right, and not heavily processed white flour.
Absolutely. Yes, for sure, whole grains. There's evidence from centenarian populations that diets that are rich in veggies and fruit and whole grains, nuts, seeds, legumes, so a plant-based diet is really healthy for you. But when we're saying plant-based diet, we always mean as natural as possible, whereas refined grains could be could be a little bit hard on the body. They can really increase your insulin response, and they're not as healthy as the whole grains that actually are very rich in vitamins and minerals.
Let's go to another caller now. Roberta is on the line in New Berlin. Roberta, hi.
Hi. You got me concerned about the water I drink. I drink reverse osmosis water. Is that also lacking in minerals and so on?
Lisa,
what kind of water?
It's reverse osmosis, that filtering process.
It depends on the filters. I think every filter has different specifications, and in general, many strong filters remove the nutrients from the water along with toxins or other things that are good to be removed. In case the filtering process is not known and we don't know if the water contains minerals and electrolytes, I think it's good to take a mineral supplement along with the water just to make sure that you have all the electrolytes and the minerals that you need.
Thanks for that call, Roberta. Lisa, I think when people think about eating more healthy, whether they're for their brains or anything, they think it's a suffering process. They're giving up stuff they like and eating boring, bland stuff. You have some recipes in your book. What are some of your favorite delicious brain-boosting recipes?
Oh, that's a really good question. I really like Buddha bowls.
Buddha bowls?
I don't know if you're familiar with them. Yeah.
You've got a recipe for that in the book, right?
Yes, there's one in the book. There are a couple on my website. I really like them. They're combinations of all sorts of roasted greens and root veggies and grains and chickpeas or lentils, if you like lentils. And the dressings are just amazing. And they taste so good. They're plant-based. They're very low in fat. They're low in cholesterol. They're very rich in fiber and vitamins and minerals, and it tastes delicious.
Yeah, the recipe you have in the book
is really not deprivation.
You've got a sweet potato chickpea Buddha bowl in the book. That sounds really good.
Yeah, it's really good. They're really, really delicious. I'm Italian, so I really care about food. Like I love eating, and I want to eat good quality food, very nutritious.
And you're from Italy, and the Mediterranean diet, people recommend it for a lot of different reasons, and it sounds like a lot of what's in the Mediterranean diet is going to be good for our brains too. Is that right?
Yes, for sure. So if you look all over the world, there are communities of people, the centenarians, who live up to age 100 or even older than that, and they're sharp as a tack. They're doing fantastic. They're probably healthier than you know, a 40-year-old. In comparison, and they're all over the world. There's a community in Italy, in Sardinia, one in Greece, one in Japan, one in South America, one actually in California. And they're very distant geographically, but they all have in common eating a very similar diet, very high in fresh fruit and veggies, especially local, freshly harvested, and then whole grains, legumes, nuts and seeds, and very healthy oils like extra virgin olive oil, but also sweet potatoes. In Japan, the centenarians in Okinawa really eat a lot of sweet potatoes. They're actually purple.
That sounds fantastic. We'll leave it there, Lisa. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
That's Lisa Mosconi. She's Associate Director of the Alzheimer's Prevention Clinic at Weill Cornell Medical College. She's a neuroscientist and a nutritionist. She joined us to talk about her new book, Brain Food, The Surprising Science of Eating for Cognitive Power. Following up on some strong Olympic performances by Wisconsinites, the state is once again represented at the pinnacle of human competition. A Whitefish Bay couple won big on The Wheel of Fortune on an episode that aired last night. As reported in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, Carly and Aaron Mandel spun the wheel in a special couples edition of the game show. They ended up with $127,000 in prizes, including a Caribbean island vacation. Along the way, their winning phrases included chewy jerky, and even though they're not Star Wars fans, they solved this phrase.
These aren't the droids you're looking for.
These aren't the droids we're looking for. The couple is thinking of using their non-vacation winnings to invest in a fixer-upper property. And I used to watch a lot of Wheel of Fortune and Jeopardy, too. And in the comfort of my own home, I was pretty good and thought, oh, yeah, I'd be a pretty good contestant on those shows. And then you wonder, you're there under the spotlight and Pat or Alex, depending on the show, are looking at you. I feel like it would be really easy to freeze up and fail on those shows and find yourself at a sudden loss for things to say of the words. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.